Ladies and gentlemen, it gives me the greatest pleasure to introduce Professor Melvin Loeffler. Professor Loeffler comes to us via Oxford, where he's spending some leave time as Harmsworth Professor, from the University of Virginia, a most distinguished institution founded by Thomas Jefferson. That's not George Washington University, as it says on the poster. Professor Loeffler's extensive work on U.S. foreign policy is well known indeed, probably to many of you, and in particular, his contribution to an understanding of the subject that he'll be discussing tonight, the dynamics of the Cold War. His major work on its beginnings, preponderance of power, the United States and the origins of the Cold War, was published in 1992 and immediately won very considerable and fully deserved acclaim for its dispassionate analysis of the geopolitical and strategic as well as the economic and diplomatic origins of the conflict. Based on exhaustive research in U.S. archives, cogently presented, it won no fewer than three major awards, the Bancroft, Farrell, and Hoover Prizes. Well, his subject tonight promises, I think, a genuine treat as he follows further afield the issues that he so effectively analyzed for the Truman period: geopolitics, ideology, and the dynamics of the Cold War. Professor Loeffler.
It's truly a great pleasure to be here, where so much wonderful international history is written and taught. And this is really one of the center places of the world to be studying diplomacy and international history. So I'm delighted to be here. As many of you know, I finished my book, Preponderance of Power, about a decade ago. It went to my editor at Stanford University Press literally 1 week before the coup, the attempted coup. And since the first full words of the introduction were "the Cold War is over," I got very nervous, thinking, what happens if this coup succeeds and the Cold War is not over? Not that any of the substance of the book really would be affected, but I was wondering what people would think of me to have so grossly misjudged what had happened. So I remember saying to my editor, you better hold this for a few days or weeks and see what happens. Ever since I finished Preponderance, I've been reading lots and lots of the new books and articles, especially those based on the materials and archival resources of Eastern European nations and Russia. As all of you know, when I worked on my book, those resources were not available, and I wouldn't have had the language skills to really deal with them very effectively in any case. But I was extraordinarily interested to see to what extent the new materials would cause me to reshape or rethink some of my basic conclusions in Preponderance of Power. And so I've spent a lot of time reading that material. Some of the time was spent as well for 4 years in the middle 1990s as an administrator and dean, where I had very little time to do anything but run a college. But last year, I went back in a serious way to studying the Cold War. I spent a year at the Woodrow Wilson Center in Washington as a fellow, and I had the opportunity to work there with the documents collected by the Cold War International History Project. Mostly, but not exclusively, these were documents that related to the end of the Cold War, and they came from Polish, Hungarian, Romanian, German, and of course Russian archival materials, all translated into English thanks to a huge amount of money that is poured into the Cold War International History Project. And they provided me with an opportunity to look at the end of the Cold War from a more international perspective. At the same time, last year, I spent a lot of time at an archive called the National Security Archive, which is not an official American governmental archive, but an archive that collects, through Freedom of Information requests, enormous amounts of material about national security policy. And they have a special new collection that relates to the materials relating to the end of the Cold War. And I got there about this time last year, and I was very, very much, very fortunate to be one of the first to look at an enormous new group of materials that had just been secured through the Freedom of Information Act with regard to the end of the Cold War, including virtually every conversation between Gorbachev and Ronald Reagan and Gorbachev and George Bush Sr., all of which are now available for research, as well as many of the American planning documents for the summit meetings between Gorbachev and Reagan and Gorbachev and Bush. As a result of a lot of this reading and this archival investigation, I decided to go ahead with a project that I had been thinking about for a number of years, and that is a new book about the entirety of the Cold War that would look at such issues as what were the basic causes of the Cold War, now that we have so many new documents from the Eastern side, what were the factors that sustained the Cold War over time, and why did the Cold War end when it did end? My aim would be to try to understand the underlying dynamics of the Cold War. But at the same time, I do not want to write a narrative history of the Cold War. Indeed, my aim is to write a focused, analytic book. As an historian, of course, I'm interested in the documentary record. As an historian, I also like to see complexity, or at least I'm inclined to see complexity. That's the subtle interrelationships of causal variables. In fact, over time, as a historian, I have become more and more impressed with contingency and with agency in history, and more suspicious of deterministic and theoretical interpretations of complex human events. But also, as a scholar deeply interested in the functioning of the international system, and a person deeply impressed by the role of both ideology and power in the interaction of states, I've at the same time been reading more and more in the theoretical literature dealing with realism, neorealism, liberalism, identity, culture, and constructivism. My goal then, as I think about a new book that I've not written at one chapter yet, but as I think about it, my aim is to write a focused, analytic, historical book that illuminates the dynamics of the Cold War, that discusses agency and contingency, and that sheds light on some of the theoretical debates. This is a pretty daunting challenge, and I'm not sure how I'm going to go about doing it exactly. But I thought I would use tonight, as well as some other opportunities while I'm here in England, to sort of frame the issues, the organization, and some of the tentative methodological approaches that I have in mind, and really use this as an opportunity to hear your reactions and then to rethink and reassess as I go along. So how do you write a book of this sort? How even to organize a book of this sort? Let me tell you how I'm thinking of organizing it. I've identified moments in time, what I call moments in time, when there seemed to be a desire to avoid a Cold War, or to tame the Cold War, or to transcend the Cold War. There actually were many such moments during the Cold War, although in my book, I'm only planning to look at five such moments. The interesting issue is why these moments proved so fleeting until the late 1980s. Why were the opportunities and desires not translated into action? Why could policymakers in Washington and Moscow not disentangle themselves from a dialectic, that they understood in many ways to undermine their interests, rationally perceived and conceived. I shall begin by looking at the immediate post-war years, 1945-48, when I will argue that neither Truman nor Stalin wanted a Cold War, yet it came. Why? I then plan to look closely at the year 1953 and early 1954 and the struggle in the Kremlin that followed Stalin's death. Beria, Milenkov, Khrushchev, and others maneuvered for power. They were worried, perhaps even frightened. The Korean War was stalemated. Washington might escalate if an armistice was not negotiated. The American strategic buildup had been of huge proportions, and Moscow's incentives to avoid a full-scale war were great. There was also unrest in East Germany and Eastern Europe. The Kremlin's new leaders had reason to reconsider their overall foreign policy, and Milenkov quickly indicated that he was so interested. It came at a time when the new American president, Dwight Eisenhower, was ordering a comprehensive reassessment of the foreign policy of the United States. And Prime Minister Churchill saw the moment, as many of you know, as particularly opportune to relax tensions and effectuate some sort of detente. But nothing came of it. Why? A third moment in time, when circumstances and self-interest both seemed to adumbrate a lasting relaxation of tensions, followed the Cuban Missile Crisis. Both Khrushchev and Kennedy were sobered by having gone to the brink. Kennedy gave a famous speech at American University envisioning a possible reconfiguration of the Cold War dynamic, of transcending the zero-sum assumptions that locked both sides into continuous and frightening competition. Khrushchev, for reasons of personal and national self-interest, was willing to engage Kennedy. They negotiated a limited test ban treaty and talked about many other measures, including an ambitious joint space program. But nothing came of this. Kennedy was shot. Khrushchev was overthrown. By mid-1965, it was clear that their successors, Johnson, Brezhnev, and Kosygin, although not unaware of the advantages of détente, could not overcome systemic pressures, ideological assumptions, and domestic political imperatives. After taking office in 1969, Nixon and Kissinger revived an interest in détente. They thought it would serve U.S. interests when domestic political and economic constraints narrowed. But détente unraveled very quickly in the years between the signing of the Helsinki agreements and the Soviet intervention in Afghanistan. Why was this the case? When both sides recognized that the strategic arms race was unwinnable as well as destructive of domestic priorities, why was this the case when both sides recognized that competition in the Third World was both expensive and dangerous? Indeed, why was this the case when both sides recognized that they were often the pawns of clever and repugnant clients? So why did détente founder? And given its demise in the late 1970s, how could it flower again so quickly by the mid-1980s? How could it flower when in Washington you had a committed Cold Warrior in the White House, and when in Moscow you had a dynamic, energetic new leader who had come through the party's ranks and had earned the respect and support of the KGB? Hardly anyone could foresee the unfolding of events, the relaxation of tensions, the end of the bipolar Cold War, and the relatively peaceful dissolution of the Soviet Union itself. How could all this have happened? Where do we look? At the evolution of the international system and the distribution of power, at the role of ideology, at domestic politics and institutions, at the influence of great men, at Reagan, at Gorbachev? In short, I believe you can tell an important story about the evolution of the Cold War by looking at these moments in history during the Cold War, these short periods of time when policymakers in Washington and Moscow tantalizingly glimpsed the need to avoid the Cold War or escape war from it, but were unable or unwilling to do so. The story then is a history of powerful men seeking to pursue a rational definition of self-interest as they understood it, but enveloped by ideological assumptions, buffeted by domestic pressures, and ensnared in a dynamic and anarchic international system that engendered both perceptions of threat and opportunity. To what extent did the configuration of the international system and the distribution of power within it shape the Cold War? To what extent did ideology, the beliefs, mindsets, and values of the leaders dictate policy and sustain the Cold War? To what extent were these leaders engulfed by domestic political pressures or bureaucratic politics or organized pressure groups? Or to what extent were they manipulated by allies and clients cleverly seeking to pursue their own interests rather than those of the hegemons in Moscow or Washington? Or to what extent should we focus on human agency? Was the Cold War the intended or unintended consequence of the will and personalities of great men? John Gaddis writes that the Cold War was the product of Stalin, the personification of the evil empire itself. Stalin, of course, was the vilest of rulers. But the truth of the matter is that during the Cold War, Washington and Moscow were populated with some of the most interesting and charismatic men of the 20th century. Khrushchev, Gorbachev, Kennedy, and Reagan among them, but also Truman and Johnson, figures of extraordinary interest in their own right, men who inherited the presidency and were then entrapped by the dynamics they could not control. What then does all this add up to in terms of understanding human agency in international relations? In today's lecture, of course, I cannot address all these issues or all these matters or all these time periods. But I can give you a flavor of the drift of my analysis and ask for your thoughts. This is a work in progress where I am learning every day, where new and exciting documents appear regularly, where reasonable men and women will differ greatly. But the stakes are high in terms of understanding a big chunk of the international history of the 20th century, and in terms of the debates over realism and constructivism, geopolitics and ideology, agency and contingency in history. So I want to stress 7 key points, only half of Wilson's 14 points, keep in mind, just 7. First, we must not separate geopolitics and ideology as alternative explanations. We must embrace them in relation to one another. Second, we must focus on the thoughts, assumptions, perceptions, and goals of key decision makers and grasp them in the context of their time and their experience. Third, the Cold War must be understood in terms of power politics being played out in an anarchic international system that did engender enormous fears about survival. The anarchic international system, I want to stress, engendered both perceptions of threat and opportunity that contributed greatly to the rivalry of the superpowers. Fourth, the perceptions of threat and opportunity, however, were shaped by ideology. The leaders of the two superpowers and their peoples believed deeply in their political and economic systems, in their ways of organizing social, economic, and political life. Their ideological mindsets did not simply shape goals as we usually think of them. Their ideological mindsets also shaped perceptions of threat and opportunity. 5. Powerful systemic forces and deeply entrenched ideological axioms were far more important than particular individuals in causing and perpetuating the Cold War dynamic. I do not think that either Truman or Stalin were critical to the origins of the Cold War, nor do I think that Reagan or Bush were critical to the ending of the Cold War, but Gorbachev was. 6. Gorbachev's importance is that he chose to see things in different ways than his predecessors. He was not entrapped by inherited ideological assumptions. He saw few threats and even fewer opportunities abroad, providing him with even more incentive to concentrate on domestic reform at home. The reasons for his perceptions cannot be grasped without understanding changes going on in the international system, but he interpreted the changes in unique ways. 7. The Cold War ended because Gorbachev failed. If he had succeeded at reforming socialism and making it work, the United States would have continued to wage a Cold War. For the Cold War to end, it was essential for Soviet power to disintegrate and for its ideology to be extinguished and for its capacity to dominate Europe and Asia to vanish. Let me illustrate how I've come to these conclusions or tentative hypotheses by looking quickly at the beginning and the end of the Cold War. Critical to understanding the onset of the Cold War between 1945 and 1948 was the configuration of the international system. I think it had four key features. First, there was an emerging bipolarity with great vacuums of power emanating from the defeat of Germany and Japan. Second, within units of the international system, great ideological struggles were underway between communists, socialists, liberals, Christian Democrats, and democratic capitalists. The outcome of these internal struggles had enormous significance for the distribution of power in the international system. Communism had more adherents than ever before. The image of the Soviet Union never had been greater. Marxism-Leninism had wide appeal. How much was uncertain. Decolonization, third, decolonization was beginning. The British were pulling out of India. The Americans were granting independence to the Philippines. Ho Chi Minh and Sukarno were calling for the expulsion of the French and the Dutch from Indochina and Indonesia. Revolutionary nationalism was underway. It would become an embedded feature of the international system for 3 decades. The Cold War, as it unfolded, is incomprehensible without understanding the importance of this phenomenon. Fourth, the international system was bipolar, but it was a peculiar bipolarity. The United States possessed a monopoly of atomic weapons, a strategic air force, a powerful navy, and access to overseas bases. The United States possessed, indeed, half the world's wealth. The Soviet Union in the mid-40s was devastated. If you added the GDP of the United States and the Soviet Union, the United States had about 85% of the total. I would suggest that these were the objective realities of the international system as it existed in the aftermath of World War II. Ideology shaped the meaning to be derived from these objective realities. Ideology shaped perceptions of threat and opportunity. From the Soviet perspective, victory in war demonstrated the superiority of the Soviet system, the command economy of one-party rule. Victory legitimized a system that never had achieved legitimacy and that had been deeply tarnished in the 1930s. Stalin emerged, however, at the height of his power. But threats existed, and they seemed very real. The number one threat was German revival. Nothing was more on Stalin's mind. He reiterated these views in conversation after conversation. In 1871, Stalin said, and I'm quoting, "Germany attacked France. 40 years later, in 1914, Germany attacked again. After the last World War, Germany restored its strength and began to wage war in 1939. Germany possesses an immense regenerative capability. If effective solutions are not implemented, we will have a new war in 15 years. Since Germany would revive, Stalin told the new Polish provisional government in June 1944, there is, quote, need for an agreement of 4 states, Poland, the Soviet Union, England, and America, end quote. Stalin was not eager for a rift with the United States. If an entente or a detente were preserved, the United States might help control the revival of German power. The United States might also facilitate the payment of reparations from the Western zones in Germany. The United States might also provide loans and aid for reconstruction of the Soviet Union. But ideology interceded. Capitalist powers were inherently hostile. They could not be trusted. They might try to harness German power against the Soviet Union. They might disintegrate into warring factions again, engulfing the Soviet Union in conflict. One way or another, the United States might try to use its superior strength to shape the international system in its own image. Stalin saw the United States wielding its atomic monopoly to forge a peace in its own interests. This did not surprise him. This is the way capitalist powers acted. The situation was fraught with danger. But ideology also suggested opportunity to Stalin. He did not see only threats. He saw opportunity. The war vested the Soviet Union with great appeal. Everyone in post-war Europe remembered the Depression and the failure of capitalism to deal with it. Communist parties in France, in Italy, and elsewhere had tremendous opportunities if they simply played their cards right, entered into popular coalitions, won support, and waited for the post-war economy to collapse. There was no need then for Stalin to grasp for power. The situation was fluid. It made no sense to provoke the English and the Americans so long as there appeared both reason and opportunity to cooperate for mutual benefit. Stalin wanted security in Eastern Europe, and he wanted friendly governments, but he did not want confrontation. Time, Stalin assumed, was on his side. Such thinking accorded with fundamental communist axioms. From the perspective of the United States, the configuration of power in the international system seemed very portentous. The United States had preponderant power, but it could erode easily. Leftist parties in Europe were strong. They could win power and could align on their own volition with the Kremlin. The future of Germany and Japan was uncertain. They could be lured into the Soviet orbit. At the same time, revolutionary nationalists in the Third World had great appeal. Marxism-Leninism explained away their country's backwardness and blamed it on imperialism. A command economy portended rapid modernization. Parts of the Third World might gravitate into a Soviet bloc. All this seemed very worrisome. Ideology and experience suggested that totalitarian nations would be aggressive, would seek to extinguish freedom. Even if the Soviet Union did not engage in military aggression, it could threaten America's core values. The Kremlin's command economy and autarkical policies would regiment much of the Eurasian economy, orienting it to support the Kremlin's potential war-making machine. Prudence meant that the United States would need to prepare for war should these eventualities occur. The United States, therefore, might have to become a garrison state. In 1947, Kennan believed, and he said that it was the view of everyone he knew in government, that the deterioration in European conditions would not only compel the United States to adopt a new political military strategy, but also a new way of domestic life. The system of free enterprise was endangered. For U.S. officials, therefore, the shape of the international system was portentous indeed. Threats existed everywhere, and not simply or even primarily from the existence of Soviet military power. Indeed, few thought that the Kremlin would embark on premeditated aggression. But the threat was worrisome because of the vacuums of power in Germany and Japan, the ideological struggles in France and Italy, and the revolutionary nationalist efflorescence beginning in Southeast Asia. Ideological axioms warned that communisms were akin to one another, that totalitarian regimes would be aggressive, that regimentation and autarky would cause abroad would cause regimentation and autarky and statism at home. The threats then were perceived as real, but the United States had the material and the strategic power to alter these threats, to reverse these threats. Washington had the atomic bomb. Washington had the money, technology, and organizational skills. If American officials could mobilize the will, they believed they had the resources and the power to preserve the preponderance that was now in their favor, but that seemed so tenuous. The atomic bomb, Secretary of State Burns said, had given us great power, and in the last analysis, quote unquote, it would control. This did not mean that Truman wanted a Cold War. He did not. "I'm not afraid of Russia," he jotted in his diary on June 7, 1945. "They've always been our friends, and I cannot see why they cannot always be," end quote. The Russians were ruled by a ruthless dictator, but this was of no consequence to Truman. Quote, they evidently like their government or they would not die for it. I like ours, so let's get along, quote, end quote. Truman, in fact, felt no personal repugnance for Stalin. After meeting him at Potsdam, Truman wrote his wife, and I'm quoting, "I like Stalin. He's straightforward, knows what he wants, and will compromise when he can't get it," end quote. Years later, in a talk at Columbia University, he repeated this view many years later. Stalin, he said, turned out to be a liar, but at the time, quote, end quote, "I liked him a lot." What is interesting, then, is that initially, neither Stalin nor Truman wanted a Cold War. Truman wanted to concentrate on controlling inflation, lowering taxes, and converting the economy to peacetime. Stalin wanted security along his expanded frontiers, and he wanted control of German power. But the latter might be done in collaboration with the West, and the West might also provide loans and allow reparations for the vast project of domestic reconstruction. So each leader had reason to cooperate, at least on terms that served his respective self-interest. But however much they might have wanted to avoid confrontation, the configuration of the international system, the specter of German power, the clash of ideologies, the spread of revolutionary nationalism, and the advent of atomic weapons conspired against a permanent détente or more relaxed forms of competition. Whereas in 1945, Stalin talked repeatedly about sustaining the Entente and imagined the possibility of ongoing collaboration despite ideological differences. By late 1947 and early 1948, Stalin's rhetoric was totally different. The world, he told the Politburo on March 14, 1948, was divided into two hostile camps. Their, and I'm quoting, "their respective points of view are absolutely irreconcilable. If one of the camps does not capitulate to the other, armed conflict between them will be absolutely inevitable," end quote. This radical change of disposition was not something that Stalin willed or planned. It was the result of the peculiar interaction of circumstance and ideology. The international system conjured up threats that Stalin could not ignore and opportunities that he could not resist. Given the ideological mindset in the Kremlin, given the anarchic structure of the international system, given the experience of the prior 30 years, it is hard to imagine anyone in the Kremlin in the late 40s acting very differently than Stalin in terms of foreign policy. Other Soviet leaders might have been more restrained in Iran and Turkey, but they might have been tempted to act even more boldly in support of the Greek or Italian communists. Would any Soviet leader have withdrawn from Eastern Europe or relinquished control over Eastern Germany in the 1940s? I don't think so. the international system was too forbidding. Experience and ideology reified the perception of threat that lurked in the international system. Moreover, and perhaps most importantly, Truman himself was not reacting to Stalin or Stalinism. He was fearful that the Kremlin might lure all of Germany into its orbit. Truman was frightened by the ideological appeal of communism. Yet he was also confident of America's superior strategic power should war erupt. Truman, therefore, would not allow time to unfold as Stalin hoped. Where Stalin saw opportunity, Truman saw risk. And when the president announced the Truman Doctrine, launched the Marshall Plan, and set about rebuilding Germany and framing the North Atlantic Treaty, Stalin saw confrontation. The Kremlin was now ready to wage the Cold War openly and everywhere. Stalin immediately grasped for advantage in the Third World, where opportunities beckoned and where the United States was vulnerable and incapacitated by its friendship with democratic allies, with colonial empires. The Cold War, I'm arguing, was inscribed in the context of the period, the configuration of the international system, the fear of Germany, the ideological appeal of statist solution to the problems of human well-being, the unraveling of colonial empires, and the shadows cast by atomic and nuclear weapons engendered fears and hopes, risks and opportunities that almost guaranteed confrontation. Stalin and Truman were engulfed by these larger forces. Geopolitics and ideology, rather than personality, were crucial. And geopolitics and ideology were inextricably related to one another, because ideology was the lens through which the international system was interpreted, through which threats were perceived, opportunities glimpsed, core values defined, and the future envisioned. But the international system, in fact, was anarchic, where there lurked real dangers and real opportunities, and where leaders of different ideological mindsets could see legitimate threats, and where they could ponder prospective gains as well as losses. Let's fast forward for a few minutes to the middle 1980s, and let's look at the international system as it then existed. This sets the framework for the end of the Cold War. Several features stand out. First, the configuration of the international system was still bipolar, and in some respects less dangerous and more stable than in the 1940s and 50s. The alliances had cohered, and the two Germanys and one Japan had been integrated into the respective orbits of the two superpowers. China, of course, was a wild card. But the balance, especially in Europe, was bipolar and institutionalized more or less through the Helsinki agreements. Second characteristic in the mid-80s, the fierce competition for ideological and political ascendancy within European states had abated. Third, in the Third World, the era of decolonization ended with the disintegration of the Portuguese Empire in the mid-1970s. The revolutionary nationalist moment in history was now history, although turbulence in many Third World nations persisted. Marxism-Leninism, however, no longer enticed many followers, as the imperialists were gone and revolutionary nationalist leaders themselves had to bear responsibility for the progress made or unmade. Nor did the command economy have the same allure as the Soviet economy faltered, state planning foundered, and the Chinese embarked on a course of gradual economic reform. Fourth, in the realm of technology, the nuclear arms race seemed continually stalemated at higher and higher levels of destructive capabilities, notwithstanding SALT and the ABM Treaty. In the mid-80s, the Americans had just finished a new round of gigantic military advances fueled by rumors of Soviet superiority in the preceding decade. New technologies based on the electronics and the computer revolutions portended vast new breakthroughs and inspired the Strategic Defense Initiative, SDI or Star Wars. A vast array of lasers and satellites, new missiles, miniature warheads, and other devices that might allow for the defense of the American homeland or that might facilitate preemption in a crisis. These were four key features of the international system. What meaning was to be derived from these features was significantly shaped by ideology. Ronald Reagan viewed the international system, as had many of his predecessors, but with more fervor. Ideology shaped Reagan's belief system. The Soviet Union was evil. Communist advances anywhere would redound to the benefit of the Kremlin. Soviet rulers needed a foreign enemy to justify their totalitarian regime at home. Totalitarianism meant aggression. World conquest was the Kremlin's ultimate aim. Freedom and self-determination were at risk everywhere. This was Reagan's belief system. But for Reagan, the international system now spawned opportunities that had not existed before. Reagan was a much more confident Cold Warrior than his predecessors. He saw more opportunities than threats. Indeed, he was willing to negotiate with the Soviets after 1983 because he was increasingly confident of the robustness of his military buildup and of America's economic renewal. Confident of American strength, he was willing to support militarily the opponents of the Kremlin's clients, whether they be the Mujahideen in Afghanistan or the Contras in Nicaragua. Planning documents for Reagan's meetings with Gorbachev now reveal that his aides were conscious of the mounting power of the United States and of the erosion of the attraction of communism. Quote, "The once widespread appeal of Marxism-Leninism in Asia," commented one State Department analyst, "has faded as the socialist countries have lagged far behind the free market economies of the region in trade and in investment," end quote. Similar trends were evident in Africa. The significant point is that Gorbachev saw these trends much as did Reagan. Reagan saw opportunity, and Gorbachev could have seen threat, but he did not. And this is where the story of the end of the Cold War really begins, I think. It begins with threat perception. Simply stated, Gorbachev believed that the Soviet Union was much more endangered by its anemic economy, social stagnation, ideological cynicism, and technological backwardness than by any external threat. The international system was indeed anarchic, but Gorbachev did not see it as the primary threat to the Soviet Union's core values. In fact, he withdrew from Afghanistan and gradually retrenched from commitments and expenditures in Asia and Central America, in Africa, Central America, the Middle East. At sub-meetings, in their fascinating reading, Reagan hammered Gorbachev with charges of intrusion and subversion. And Gorbachev invariably was on the defensive. He disputed the president's allegations that the Kremlin was fomenting revolution around the world. The Soviet Union, he said, quote, "did not consider that a way of life could be imposed if a society were not ready for it," end quote. Gorbachev said that he didn't awake each morning pondering where he could arrange a new revolution. This, he said, quote, "is simply not true." Rather than escalate the competition, however, Gorbachev chose to retrench. At the Moscow summit in May 88, Gorbachev stressed to Reagan his strong desire to resolve regional disputes, Peaceful coexistence, he insisted, should be the universal principle of international relations. In fact, he introduced a document saying, quote, equality of all states, non-interference in internal affairs, and freedom of socio-political choice must be recognized as the inalienable and mandatory standards of international relations, end quote. For Moscow, the worldwide ideological struggle was waning. In Europe, as well as the Third World, communism was faltering. Whereas at the end of World War II, Stalin had reason to hope for, and Truman had reason to fear, the spread of communism throughout Europe, by the mid-80s, the socio-economic landscape had been transformed, and so had the ideological discourse and political dynamics. According to one of his closest aides, Gorbachev grasped that the Soviet Union, quote, had lost the ideological war which the Soviet Union had been conducting for so many decades, end quote. In Western Europe, democratic capitalism, market economies, and the social welfare state had triumphed. In Eastern Europe, planned economies and one-party rule had failed. In his memoirs, Gorbachev acknowledged that when he occasionally traveled in the West in the 1960s and 70s, his, quote, belief in the superiority of socialist democracy over the bourgeois system was shaken as I observed the functioning of civic society and the different political systems. One question especially, quote, end quote, haunted him. Why was the standard of living in our country so much lower than in other developed countries, end quote. Gorbachev desperately wanted to renew the vitality of socialism in his country. He hoped to do so through democratization and restructuring. By reducing spending, he sought to end the arms race, reallocate expenditures, and focus on domestic priorities. In contrast to the years immediately after World War II, when economic needs actually were even more pressing, Gorbachev chose to eradicate the image of the enemy. In contrast to Stalin in 1946, and especially in 1948, Gorbachev used the rhetoric of dialectical materialism to conclude that capitalism had been tempered. Ideology, Gorbachev argued, should be excised from the discourse of diplomacy and foreign affairs. Gorbachev was willing to apply this thinking even to Eastern Europe. The first principle of international relations, he declared in 1988, was, quote, the recognition of the freedom of social and political choice by each people and each country. By this time, Gorbachev knew that socialism had lost its appeal in Eastern Europe and could not be salvaged even but through the use of force. In a memorandum prepared for him in February 1989, he read, quote, the European socialist countries find themselves in a powerful magnetic field emanating from the economic growth and social well-being of West European states. Against this background, socialist achievements grow dim, end quote. Gorbachev acknowledged that the social and political orders of countries had changed in the past and would change in the future. He withdrew Soviet troops and accepted, however grudgingly, the overthrow of communist regimes, so long as there was no direct Western intervention. He did so because he did not believe that fundamental Soviet security imperatives were endangered. He understood that European socialist countries formed, and I'm quoting, a security belt, which created a strategic umbrella for the center of socialism, end quote. But he was advised that a transfer of power to alternative forces does not mean an external and military threat to our country. He was encouraged to liberate himself from the notion, quote, that only a communist party can provide guarantees of security for Soviet borders, end quote. He was willing to do so. His aim, he himself told the Politburo in October 1988, was to break down the Iron Curtain, Fulton in reverse, he explicitly acknowledged. Gorbachev did not see traditional Soviet threats to Soviet security. Gorbachev did not see traditional threats to Soviet security. In fact, he departed dramatically from traditional interpretations of security needs, partly because of the way he perceived threats, partly because of the need for economic reforms, and partly because of his views of nuclear weapons. Early on, his aide, Anatoly Chernyayev, noted the General Secretary's intent to curb the arms race and reduce nuclear weapons. My impression, wrote Chernyayev on January 16, 1986, quote, is that Gorbachev's really decided to end the arms race no matter what. He is taking this risk because, as he understands it, it is no risk at all, because nobody would attack us, even if we disarmed. And in order to get the country on solid ground, we have to relieve it of the burden of the arms race, which is a drain on more than just the economy, end quote. In short, additional arms added nothing to security, encouraged illusory risk-taking, and burdened the economy. The world had vastly changed, and Gorbachev developed his own strong views about the meaning of these changes. The existing nuclear balance guaranteed the Soviet Union against aggression. The arms race consequently made no sense. It was, quote, end quote, a stupid dialectic, Gorbachev told the Politburo on June 20th, 1988. It was important, he acknowledged, to be militarily strong, quote, but for purposes of security, not for purposes of intimidation, end quote. The real threats to the Soviet system emanated from within, from the failure of the system to appeal as it once had. Nobody, Gorbachev said, wants to live in the old way anymore. To repeat, Gorbachev did not think that Soviet survival was endangered by the rivalry of states or the clash of ideological systems. Quote, despite the profoundly contradictory nature of the modern world, he said, and despite, quote, the fundamental differences of states which comprise it, it is mutually connected, mutually dependent, and forms an integral whole, end quote. Gorbachev believed, in fact, that the internal contradictions of capitalism had been tempered, whereas Stalin thought that it was impossible to resolve the contradictions that precipitated intra-capitalist conflict. Gorbachev explicitly found that this was no longer true. Quote, both capitalism and socialism are changing. The lessons of the last war, the strength of socialism, and the logic of technological change forced capitalist nations to modulate their differences, reconcile contradictions, and balance interests. With Chernobyl constantly in his mind, he emphasized that nuclear and ecological threats dictated the transcendence of common human values. Peace, he insisted, was in the interests of all nations. This comported with Leninist thinking, Gorbachev stressed time and time again. This mindset, I should say, was shaken briefly and significantly by the unanticipated turn of events in Germany during late 1989 and 90, the fall of the Berlin Wall and the precipitous moves toward German unification profoundly disturbed Gorbachev. The specter of a renewed threat emanating from a united Germany concerned him as did no other foreign policy matter. Quote, I was 14 when the war ended. Our generation is the generation of wartime children. It has burned us, leaving its mark on our characters and on our view of the world. End quote. Even if Gorbachev had been inclined to forget the past, his opponents would not allow him to do so. They observed developments in Germany with trepidation, and they excoriated Gorbachev for compromising Soviet security. Nonetheless, he proceeded to acquiesce to the unification of Germany. Initially, he did not want Germany unified, and then he did not want it ensconced in NATO. But his fears were tempered by the realization that he was dealing with a Germany that had been peaceful for almost two generations. His meetings and conversations with Kohl and Genscher at critical moments during 1989 and 90 vividly reveal the efforts of the generation raised in wartime to overcome the legacy of their youth and to forge a new order based on common values. However uncertain about future dangers, and however buffeted by his domestic foes, Gorbachev realized that if he tried to thwart the movement toward German unity, he would have to use force. But force would destroy perestroika, the very essence of Gorbachev's desire to reform domestic society. For Gorbachev, with his domestic priorities imperiled, Germans' right to self-determination now trumped the importance of preserving a socialist regime in the GDR. But common values that transcended differences in ideology do not alone suffice to explain Gorbachev's actions. He entrusted Soviet security to new mechanisms. He acquiesced to a united Germany in NATO because ultimately he perceived that NATO was a critical means to control German power in the future. The presence of U.S. troops, Gorbachev told Secretary of State Baker, and I'm quoting, could be very constructive as the situation evolves. We really don't want to see a replay of Versailles where the Germans were able to arm themselves. The lessons of the past, Gorbachev said, tell us that Germany must stay within European structures, end quote. An American withdrawal from Europe, Gorbachev stated, was not in the interest of the Soviet Union, end quote. Of course, Gorbachev wanted NATO to be restructured and to be made less threatening. He also wanted to ensure that Germany would not be allowed to develop weapons of mass destruction. And he insisted that German forces in the East be limited and circumscribed. But within these parameters, he recognized that a united Germany inside NATO was less of a threat than a united Germany outside NATO, especially if the new Russia could develop a special relationship with the new Germany. For Brent Scowcroft, Bush's national security advisor, the Cold War ended when the Soviets accepted a united Germany in NATO. For Scowcroft, as for many American officials since the early post-war years, the greatest threat always had been the specter of a united Germany harnessed to an aggressive communist alliance spearheaded by the Soviet Union. The Cold War, therefore, appeared to end when the de-ideologization of Soviet foreign policy was coupled with the co-option of German power in a Western coalition. As a consequence of these developments, both the ideological threat and the strategic nightmare that had inspired America's Cold War anxieties vanished. The Soviets were no longer competing ideologically in the Third World. They were not insisting on kindred socialist regimes in Eastern Europe. They were not capable of attracting the loyalty of the peoples of Western Europe or of subverting their governments. They could not conquer or harness the resources of Europe and Asia against the United States. For Washington, the Cold War was over because it had been won, both strategically and ideologically. For Moscow, the unfolding of events could be explained by the march of time. German power, which always appeared so foreboding, seemed tempered by a new set of values and harnessed by new institutional regimes, including NATO, CSCE, and the European Union. The allure of ideological gains, so intoxicating in the early decades of the Cold War, was eroded by acceptance of the inadequacies of the Soviet model of development, by knowledge that the peoples of Eastern Europe were repudiating their regimes, and by recognition that Marxist-Leninist experiments had failed miserably in the Third World and at substantial costs to the Kremlin. The fear of atomic and nuclear blackmail, which inspired so much of the arms race, was allayed by confidence that Soviets had immense capabilities, and by knowledge that nuclear plenty made nuclear threats hollow. But events would not have unfolded as they did without the agency and leadership of Gorbachev. Once in power, he seized the levers of the regime to outline a direction in which the Soviet Union had to move. It was a direction rather than a vision, because Gorbachev had no clear blueprint of the future. He improvised and he learned, and his improvisations became ever more dramatic as he encountered unanticipated problems. But the direction was infused with real conviction, with a passionate commitment to make socialism work in his country. In his speeches, not simply his foreign policy speeches, but in all his speeches, you observe a man of deep ideological commitment. Day after day, speech after speech, Gorbachev declared that his goal was to reform and revitalize socialism. The socialist experiment, he insisted, was of great universal significance. Quote, it has offered to the world its answers to the fundamental questions of human life. Through restructuring, he preached again and again, quote, we want to unveil the vast humanist potential of the socialist system, end quote. Gorbachev, it needs to be stressed, was not interested in the socialist system for its own sake. He differed vastly from Stalin, who constantly saw the system endangered by enemies, but ignored the ultimate intentions of the system. For Gorbachev, the ends were clear. The principal goal of socialism, he said, quote, is overcoming alienation and putting man in the focus of attention, end quote. He repeated this theme many times. Stalinist distortions, he insisted, quote, led to the loss of the main thing in the Marxist-Leninist concept of socialism, the concept of man as the aim and the highest value and not a means or a cog, end quote. Gorbachev's aim then was to restore the vitality of socialism for humankind and to fulfill its potential inside the Soviet Union. His desire was to shift resources from the military budget to domestic renewal. His foreign policy was almost totally derivative, designed to serve the needs of his domestic agenda. This was possible because he neither saw great threats nor great opportunities beyond his borders. Only when the Berlin Wall came tumbling down and German unification was thrust to the forefront of international politics did Gorbachev step back and ponder traditional security issues. But even then, he believed that the Soviet Union was too strong to be endangered and that Germany was too reformed and too enmeshed in NATO to be threatening. And in exchange for agreeing to a united Germany, Gorbachev hoped he could elicit a huge economic payback that might sustain the restructuring process that was so important to him. But the very fact that he could imagine the economic benefits flowing from a united Germany to outweigh the strategic danger illuminates how vastly different the context and the agents were at the end of the Cold War compared to its beginning. As much as Stalin hoped for financial aid and reparations from the West to expedite reconstruction, he never would have traded those benefits for a united Germany linked to a capitalist coalition. Germany was simply too dangerous and the dialectics of capitalist development too portentous. The security of the Soviet Union and its communist system of political economy were not to be risked. The dangers were too great, the opportunities too vast. But for Gorbachev, the external threats were small and the external opportunities even smaller. Success for him depended on democratizing socialism and making it work. Because he had transformed the ultimate ends of the Soviet experiment from defending a system with universal claims to ameliorating the welfare of people within that system, Gorbachev was neither seeking foreign enemies nor dependent on them to preserve totalitarian rule at home. Instead, he needed friendly governments and foreign aid to buttress his attempts at socialist renewal. For him, a geopolitical landscape that had a relaxation of tensions at its core was the key to a successful reformation of socialism that had the well-being of the individual as its centerpiece. Geopolitics and ideology were still at work, still constituted the essential backdrop, but human agency transformed their meaning. Of course, Gorbachev was not operating alone. We have wonderful books illustrating the evolution of ideas inside the Soviet Union in the 1970s and 1980s. The migration of ideas was transformative. The new intellectual milieu was critical. But Gorbachev translated ideas into action based on his perception of the threats and opportunities emanating from the international system, and based on his own conception of the meaning of socialism. Gorbachev was indispensable. Leadership counts. Human agency is critical to any overall assessment of the Cold War and its denouement. Thank you. I'll be glad to answer questions or hear your comments. This is truly a work in progress, so please.
Yes.
Can I start off by probing you on what was the basic asymmetry and what was fascinating about the Cold War's beginning and end, namely the sense of the non-role of Stalin as compared to the role of Gorbachev. Your account, in many ways, very persuasive, but it did have at its core this imbalance between your rejection on the one hand of the Gaddis and all Stalin's fault interpretation of the Cold War's beginning, and your espousal of the Gorbachev won't done it account of the Cold War's end. Now, why? So, is that a fatal contradiction, or is that a contradiction that you can see your way out of? Why does one Soviet leader, in a sense, act merely as a tool and a prisoner of the system, whereas another Soviet leader is able to transcend that system and indeed ultimately to undermine and bring it down?
Well, I think a lot depends on intentions. The basic point I'm trying to develop is that I think few leaders in the Kremlin in the late 1940s would have conceived things very differently in terms of foreign policy. But certainly they might have done small things differently, but I think the basic contours would probably have been pursued. I think Gorbachev is distinctive because he develops his own views that really, I think, are quite different than most of the leaders who might have been in power in the Kremlin in the middle and late 1980s. That's not to say that there wasn't all these thoughts going around. We now know that they were. But it's hard to imagine any other leader who would have come to power in the mid and late 1980s to have done the types of things and wanted to do the types of things. Now, probably what's resonating through your mind and through the mind of others is this sort of dialogue going on in the pages of International Security over the last year, in which Bill Wolforth and Steve Brooks argue that everybody in the Kremlin was inclined to respond to the material pressures. I think lots of folks were inclined to respond to the material pressures, and that's why they say that, you know, the system and materialism are the key. But what they don't address is the ends of that. And it seems to me that Gorbachev is unique because he wasn't doing these things primarily, I believe, based on the evidence I've seen, to strengthen the Soviet Union in terms of its foreign policy posture. It wasn't to retrench in order to become primarily stronger in the long term. I think Gorbachev's uniqueness as a leader was that he really developed a different concept of socialism for his country that more or less comported in a vague way to the emerging notions of social democracy in the West. And because of his skills for many years within and also the power that he had as General Secretary, he's able to pursue that long enough to make these significant changes. However, I'm also claiming that even if he had succeeded, even given his own view of socialism, which I think is dramatically different than most of his contemporaries who might have been leaders, that the United States would not have acted differently because they never would have trusted a successful reformation of socialism itself as a long-term phenomenon that would have given the United States a sense of security in the international system. I think that therefore the Cold War would have continued. Does that help to explain, to respond to your question?
Thank you. I have a question of my own, and then Bernie Westhead has a question. My question is sort of a mischievous one. Doesn't the collapse of the Soviet Union testify, above all, to Gorbachev's complete incomprehension of the internal dynamics of his own system, which, after all, was created by Stalin based on terror and whose economic growth rate sort of declines in parallel with the Gulag population? You know, if you graph them, they sort of connect there.
Yeah, I don't... I actually think that Gorbachev had incredibly optimistic view of the ability to preserve coherence within the Soviet Empire, so to speak, and did not understand the disintegration tendencies, and they got altogether out of hand. But so I don't disagree with that, but I also don't see that bearing all that much on the basic analysis. I mean, I think that's true. He misconstrued that. But
well, the question would be, that would bear on the basic analysis following from that, would be how would you incorporate the internal dynamics of the Soviet system into the analysis? That is, the sort of trajectory of Soviet communism from Stalin forward, it seems to me, has something fairly important to do with the outcome.
With the outcome of the disintegration of the Soviet Union as an empire, yes, I'm not so sure, absolutely. But I think that's distinctive from the disintegration of the Cold War dynamic. I see those as two different elements.
Okay, well, I think I would argue that obviously I'm not a Cold War specialist, but the existence of the Soviet Union as a gigantic multinational empire protected by sword and shield of the revolution, the KGB, and enormous tank armies is, something that
should sort of bulk large in the process of the Cold War, and Gorbachev's seeming obliviousness to the fact that his rule ultimately is based on force as well as ideology, and on a particular brand of communist ideology, Stalin's, is I think, crucial to understanding why the system collapses, which ends the Cold War.
I think Gorbachev was extremely well aware of the burdens and liabilities imposed by the military establishment. And so I think he had a good grasp of that, and I think he deserves admiration for his strong desire to transcend that. What he didn't understand, of course, is exactly what you're saying, that the whole system might fall apart without that. And he certainly did not understand that. But I think in terms of understanding the foreign policy that he conducted, I'm not so sure that that bears on his foreign policy moves. What it shows is that he sort of underestimated the degree of change that he would really need to have to effectuate to make a new system work within. In fact, perhaps it was impossible.
Or the degree of force needed to maintain the system in something resembling its even 1980s form.
Yeah.
Arnie.
Five of the 7 points, as far as I can tell, really deal with the primacy of ideology in and different facets of ideology. In terms of understanding the Cold War as a very distinct international system, and as you know, this is an interpretation that I very much feel at home, so we're not carrying you on that interview. I have 2 points, really. One that is, to some extent, connected. Ideology and geopolitics, as that was the topic of your talk. One thing that's come to interest me increasingly with regard to the book is how geopolitical concepts actually are developed. In other words, as you put it yourself in your talk, how these are developed in a Cold War setting within the realm of the different ideologies. And what is so striking about this book, and this is where I think you probably have it. Is the degree to which these, as you put it, interests, rationally perceived, are twisted by ideology on both sides, so that it does not become issues such as Germany and Japan that really become the core of the conflict relative to it. Rather, it becomes issues like Vietnam or Angola or Ethiopia that become the clashes. I wonder if you have any thoughts on that. I mean, if you think about geopolitics in more limited terms, as some people call it, grand strategies. Mm-hmm. How are the terms of those grand strategies influenced by ideology of both sides? And then, secondly, the Gorbachev factor, the sixth of your acceptance, of immense importance, I believe, with regard to understanding if not just the end of the world, but also the different systems on the two sides during the Cold War itself. What we may give up is that I see a Gorbachev who came much more grudgingly and much more gradually to the convictions that he was to have, was to hold at the very end of his time in power. And I wonder how closely you look at the early period of Gorbachev's time as general secretary, maybe by, say, mid-1987, in terms of trying to understand how these new and revolutionary, I believe they knew it new and revolutionary concepts, both its use on the Soviet state and its international policies developed. How much came from the outside in terms of the pressures and the difficulties developing, not just with the Reagan administration, but certainly with that too. And then lastly, and fascinatingly, you said that the Cold War ended because the Soviet Union failed. Now in that, following on from your response to Pierce's is there also a sense that the United States ideology in terms of the perception of the world may in the long run